Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hello, and welcome back to Philosophy for Beginners. Today we continue along the 17th century road, where the smoke of civil wars hangs in the air, and the shape of the modern state is still unclear. Our guide is John Locke, born in 1632 in Somerset, a child of a modest Puritan family whose father served as a captain on the parliamentary side during England's Great Conflict. Locke grew up listening to arguments that were not merely academic. Which powers belong to a king? What does conscience owe to law? Can a nation force one faith upon many souls? He studied at Oxford, absorbed scholastic forms, and then, more importantly, found himself captured by the experimental spirit transforming Europe. He befriended Robert Boyle, learned to respect the stubbornness of facts as they appear through glass and instrument, and trained his mind to move from experience to inference, rather than from doctrine to detail. He studied medicine enough to practice, because medicine is philosophy with the pulse running. He learned how to weigh evidence when a life is in play. Friendship and fortune then yoked Locke to politics. He entered the orbit of Anthony Ashley Cooper, later the Earl of Shaftesbury, a powerful mercurial figure. Locke served as physician, secretary, counselor, and at critical moments, as quiet partner in a struggle over the shape of English liberty. Shaftesbury's career rose and fell with the tides of monarchy. Locke's life rose and fell with it. When danger sharpened, Locke slipped away to the Netherlands, where a republic's toleration sheltered his pen. When the Glorious Revolution of 1688 replaced one king with another under new constitutional terms, he returned to England carrying papers that would give a vocabulary to the age. The heart of Locke's contribution is simple enough to state, and deep enough to occupy centuries. Human beings are born free and equal. They have rights that precede government. They create governments by consent to secure those rights, and when a government destroys them, the people retain the right to alter or abolish it. He draws this not from a romantic portrait of humanity, but from a sober picture of the state of nature. Before political artifice, he imagines persons living side by side under a law discoverable by reason. That law of nature tells each of us we are proprietors of ourselves, our lives, our liberty, the work of our hands, and that no one ought to harm another in those goods. The portrait is not idyllic. Inconveniences abound in the state of nature. Partiality in judging one's own case, weakness in enforcing right, danger from those who refuse reason. But the condition is not a war of all against all. It is a condition where rights exist without institutions strong enough to protect them. Property, for Locke, is the test case that makes natural right visible. Take the world as God's garden, given in common. When someone mixes his labor with a piece of that world, cultivates a patch of ground, fells a tree, and shapes it into a beam, he makes that product his. Labor is the title. The rule has moral limits. Take only what you can use. Leave enough and as good for others. Do not let goods spoil in hoarding. The invention of money by mutual consent relaxes some of these limits because durable coins do not rot, yet the moral core remains. Property is the fruit of effort bounded by the claims of others who are your equals. This is not a celebration of greed, but a theory of stewardship, and it underwrites a politics in which people have something worth protecting before they ever sign a social contract. Government, then, is a trust. Individuals consent, explicitly by oath or tacitly by staying and using the benefits of a common life, to form a community that will appoint impartial judges, establish known laws, and wield force in defense of those laws. The legislature is supreme among institutions because it makes the rules in the name of the people. Yet its power is limited at every edge. It may not take property without the people's consent. It may not enslave. It may not govern by disguised will instead of promulgated law. When rulers break the trust, when they dissolve the laws, subvert elections, persecute conscience, or pit the armed hand of the state against the rights it was made to secure, they dissolve the compact. The people then find themselves back in a state of nature with respect to the usurpers and may resist as equals, restoring a government that truly represents them. This is the philosophical grammar of revolution. In Locke's time, it justified the settlement of 1688. Later, it supplied the sentences out of which the American Declaration of Independence was composed. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is a translation of Locke's life, liberty, and property, tuned to a new music. Locke's political thought cannot be separated from his views on knowledge and the mind. In an essay concerning human understanding, he asks, what we can know and how. He rejects innate ideas, those stamped on the soul at birth, and instead offers the image of the mind as a tabula rasa, a blank slate on which experience writes. From sensation, we gather simple ideas, colors, sounds, textures. From reflection, we gather ideas of our own operations, thinking, willing, doubting, hoping. The mind can complicate these through comparison and combination. It can name them, organize them, build sciences, but the source remains experience. This is not a council of cynicism. It is a democratization of knowledge. If ideas are not born noble, but earned by attention, then education is a moral project. Teach children to form good habits, to speak truth, to bear discomfort without drama, to love reason as a guide. Some thoughts concerning education is not just a manual for tutors. It is a political text in which character is the first constitution of a commonwealth. In this epistemology, he says something subtle about the world's furniture. He distinguishes primary qualities, shape, motion, number, extension, which belong to things as they are, from secondary qualities, color, taste, sound, which belong to the way our senses register the world. The apple is round and in motion regardless of a spectator. Its redness is a power to produce a color idea in us when light and eyes cooperate. This does not make the apple unreal. It makes perception a collaboration between thing and sense. Out of this come two moral lessons. We should be cautious in arguing from appearance to essence, and we should be patient with disagreements that may be rooted not in malice, but in the limits of sense. Locke's account of personal identity is a quiet revolution. If the mind is written on by experience, what makes a person the same person from one day to the next? Not the sameness of substance, whether soul or body, but the continuity of consciousness. You are the same person to the extent that you can remember being yourself. This thread of memory weaves responsibility through time. It is also fragile and therefore deserving of care. When you consider your future self, you can now ask a moral question with a psychological grip. What do I owe that person who will remember or fail to remember what I do today? Prudence becomes a form of justice extended in time. Religion, inflamed in his century, Locke approaches with two instruments, toleration and reason. In his letter concerning toleration, he argues that belief cannot be compelled, and that the business of government is not the salvation of souls, but the peace of the commonwealth. So long as citizens keep the law, their consciences are their own. He makes exceptions, Catholics and atheists, in his original text, revealing the constraints of his context and his own anxieties. Yet, the principle he lays down outlasts those limits. Toleration is not indifference. It is the recognition that force cannot make belief, and that shared civic life depends on a narrower, more public morality. Keep contracts, do not steal, do not injure, let your neighbor worship as his light directs. In The Reasonableness of Christianity, he attempts a modest natural theology, leaving room for a faith that complements rather than contradicts reason. It is right, reading Locke, to notice the shadows as well as the light. He invested in colonial companies and helped draft the fundamental constitutions for Carolina, a document whose compromises with slavery stain his legacy. He fought like a reformer inside an empire. Later, critics are right to insist that liberalism must expand beyond what he imagined, to include women as full citizens, to confront the theft of land masked as property, to hear voices he did not hear. Yet his core insight, that power must be justified to the people it governs, that rights precede rulers, that the individual is not a child before the state, remains a moral resource. It is the grammar in which later reformers and resistors speak, even when they correct him. Why read Locke now? Because he reminds us that freedom is not the absence of ties, but the presence of fair, public rules made by consent. Because he teaches that rights must be anchored in the ordinary labors by which people feed and house themselves. Because he treats education as a statecraft of the soul. Because his analysis of power as a trust gives citizens a clean question to ask when they suspect abuse. By what right? In an age of surveillance and data mining, of faction and fever, Locke offers a calm triage. First, secure life and liberty. Then protect property, understood as the sphere of a person's lawful work and attachments. Then design government so that the temptation to cheat the trust is checked by institutions and by a people accustomed to asking for reasons. Think of him in exile in Holland, writing under borrowed roofs while watching the weather of Europe for a change that would allow him to come home. He writes not for a court, but for readers who will have to live with the laws their betters make. He writes in long, careful sentences that expect patience, not applause. He's not asking you to love your rulers. He's asking your rulers to love your rights. He thinks human beings, even when stubborn, can be taught by experience. He believes that a child treated with respect is more likely to become a citizen who respects others. He looks at a farm and sees not only fields, but contracts between neighbors. He looks at a shop and sees not only goods, but a tacit promise that exchanges will be fair. He looks at a church and sees not only ritual, but private persuasion that cannot be commanded by the sword. This is a politics built from ordinary days. Its grandeur is not in spectacle, but in durability. Thank you for listening to this episode of Philosophy for Beginners. In our next stage, we will turn to a lens grinder in Amsterdam whose calm audacity still startles, Baruch Spinoza, who asked us to see all things under the aspect of eternity and found in understanding a path to joy. Where Locke defended rights and consent within time, Spinoza will remind us that freedom may also be the knowledge of necessity. But before we leave Locke, remember this. Liberty is not a gift a ruler bestows. It is a relationship a people insist upon and maintain with public reason and steady courage. Produced by Selenius Media. Music by The Artificial Laboratory.